Is this going to be tough for you to do your own episode, Ian?
Great question.
I mean, yes, but I think I would prefer to do my episode first in case the voice goes.
This could be an audio catastrophe.
I think it's going to
be amazing. It's going to be like, what's the opposite of ASMR?
ASMR.
If ASMR stands for amazing SMR, this is BSMR, which is bad SMR.
Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris, and this week I need help in many ways. Not only help with finding a good book, guys, right? Because that's why we're all here.
Which he always does.
Which I always succeed at, because you guys are just so good at bringing good books. And the Litheads, of course, recommend books.
Thank you, Litheads. Frequently.
Litheads, if you've read a good book recently, please share it with us. We'd love to share it with the world. We have several people in Spain and New Zealand.
Wow.
And that's our episode. Really, thanks for coming, Litheads.
Thank you. Yeah, so thank you for that.
Well, it's late for the people in New Zealand, so we have to wrap up.
That's okay. And I'm also looking for help in other ways.
Financial.
Specifically, any mostly. Type of help.
He needs to move. He's painting his
self-help.
House. Self-help. Oh, self-help.
Self-help.
Bus tickets. He needs to get to Sacramento by Tuesday.
Uh-huh. To help me finding a self-help book or two. High school English teachers,
helpful,
of course.
Helpful English teachers.
Oh, that would have been good. Mm-hmm. You've just helped me.
Yeah, good.
And now
I need,
this is a lot of help going on. Mm-hmm. It's really flying around.
Do you feel supported, Nick?
Yeah, I feel loved.
Nick and Joe, do you feel this is a supportive environment?
Yes and no.
Depends on the week.
Yes. Did anybody bring a book?
My name's Joseph Harvey Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. This week, I am excited to hear about Ian's self-help book that he brought to hopefully help all of us.
Good morning, everybody. Today, I'm Dr. Ian Horst Young. I'm a doctor of equine psychology.
Right.
And I am ready to be open with all of you. This week, I brought Dr. Brené Brown's New York Times best-selling book.
Wow.
Daring Greatly. About why we should all be open with each other and not hide behind walls, whether those are podcast walls or the walls of a stable, because a horse is after you.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Nick, is Brené Brown somebody that you have heard of before? Because in the world of schools, she's kind of a big deal, right?
Interesting.
Like, yeah, like there was
she's on the line, Joe. She's right here.
Hi, I'm Brené Brown.
It's me, Brené. I'm from Texas.
Who's Brené Brown?
When I started teaching, Brené Brown, she was everywhere. Right? She was absolutely everywhere. I'm not super sure what her background is, but she would show up at school conventions. People would play motivational videos about
uninvited.
Like, uninvited. She'd just be waiting there in the dark.
What?
Oh, okay. No, she would show up at school conventions. People would play motivational videos with her, and it would be the sort of thing where it would be like unlocking your inner power or like connecting with each other. Like that kind of woo-woo hippie stuff that's like...
Well, I don't know.
I will say that
Joe, you got to buy into the fiction here. It's self-help
in
week.
In order to succeed in the self-help space, you have to have titles that are kind of woo-woo. Mm-hmm. But this book is really wonderfully not that. I'll get into it later. But she's a psychological researcher. She like talks to people about their psychologies and stuff. She does studies and things with numbers. And this is evidence-based. This is data-based, which I love.
Has she ever been a chief human officer?
Oh, CHO.
Does she have titles like that, do you think, under her resume?
No, she has titles like PhD and professor.
Interesting.
Boy, that elitist Ian's coming out.
Because I've been doing some research in the last 35 seconds, and I'll let you know that Brené's not even her name.
Interesting.
Her name is Cassandra. Is she a liar, Ian? Let's just set the
probably.
Table.
We all lie. And you know what? She would probably, if you said that to her, she'd probably be like, you know what? Yes.
Well, she's right here, Ian.
That is a lie. She'd say that's a lie. And I lied for these specific reasons, which I thought were good. But if they hurt you, I'm sorry.
It's probably to protect her privacy.
Is there any reason why? Is it just because Brené Brown sounds better than Cassandra Brown?
It's because it sounds good. It's because she gets to put that accent a-goo over and now it's cocky. Nobody remembers Cassie Brown. Nobody wants to hear Cassie Brown speak at their convention.
Wow, okay. Mm. Back off of the name Cassie a little bit. Go ahead, Nick. Joe's very enthusiastic. Joe just hit a nerve.
That's actually Ian's actual first name. It's Cassie.
If I was podcasting with a guy named Cassie, I would punch him right in the throat.
Why is alliteration so yummy?
People like it.
Why is it so good?
I don't know, but maybe it's memorable. I do know that, like, when I discovered, when I kind of put two and two together and learned that most alter egos of Marvel superheroes are alliterative.
Right.
That blew my dang mind.
Peter Parker.
I was like, yep. Uh-huh. Bruce Banner.
Yeah.
Reed Richards. Sue Storm. And the rest.
The Batman.
Well, it's actually pronounced Batman.
When I teach my AP Lang class, like, a lot of what we do is, like, we look for rhetorical choices that authors make in order to, like, become meaningful. So students really like rhetorical, like, they look for rhetorical choices. They go rhetoric hunting. And an easy one to identify is...
I'm going Wedowick hunting.
That wasky Wedowick.
Be very, very rhetorical.
But
while hunting,
a really easy one to identify is alliteration, and students always want to talk about it. And I have been teaching this class for like 10 years at this point. And when students ask me, like, hey, if I'm going to, like, write analysis about alliteration, what do I say about it? I don't have a good answer for that question. Like, it is memorable. It's noticeable. It makes you slow down. It makes you, like, realize. I think of Bill Clinton saying, even presidents have private lives, right? Like, what a great line that is. I still think about that line.
Does that count as alliteration?
Oh, yeah. It comes in the... Let me see if I can find the whole sentence.
It does. So it doesn't just have to be a superhero name. It can be kind of just within a sentence like that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Like that pa-pa-pa-pa-pa, like twice
many
in the same
books
sentence.
We bring our bangers.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The stutter of the literary world.
I have two answers to this, Joseph. Okay. One.
Can I hear them too?
I'm gonna risk some iffy classics knowledge here.
It's okay, I'll bleep it out.
A lot of early literature was handed down orally, not written down. So if you wanted to, like, if you want a poem like Beowulf or the Iliad to survive, it had to be memorized by a dude and then taught to a little dude, and the little dude grew up and taught to another little dude, and so on.
So this is how you get Homer repeating, like, Dawn with her rose red fingers broke.
Right. So one of the ways we remember is through alliteration as creators. So I think maybe part of the reason that alliteration is so common in speeches is that it's a memorable line that, right, that the speaker, the rhetor, manages to hit. The other piece is it is memorable to us because the sounds are the same. So when we have the first sound, that's
words to remember. Who doesn't love
the
that?
Next sound,
next work to
and the
remember.
Next sound, and so on. So if you couldn't remember the end of that president quote, and you might not remember it until you said president, the word mm-hmm. president, and then you hear purr, and you're like, oh, purr, private. Mm-hmm. So I think it helps us as speech makers remember, and it also helps the listeners. It gives us a framework.
Okay,
that's enough.
Okay, that's into good. Your brain.
We've gotten into
it. Can I read the whole quote for you? And you'll hear the alliteration.
What quote about the president?
Yeah. So this is Bill Clinton in the throes of the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
It's in the news every single day.
And he came on the news one night. Like, there was a national address where he came on the news and he spoke directly to the American people.
You got to get out there, man. You got to talk to him.
And the climax of that speech is he says, I must put it right, and I'm prepared to do whatever it takes to do so. Nothing is more important to me personally, but it is private, and I intend to reclaim my family life for my family. It's nobody's business but ours. Even presidents have private lives. It's time to stop the pursuit of personal destruction and the prying into private lives and get with our national life.
So many P's.
Please, Bill Clinton, take it easy, right?
Yeah. Bill Clinton and his pee-pee.
The other thing that I really like about this speech is the speechwriter who wrote it is so proud of it that it's hanging on his bathroom wall. Like, the original draft of this speech is hanging on his wall for like all of his friends to see when they come
All things you're really proud of should be in your bathroom.
Well, like, you put it in your bathroom, right? So that you acknowledge, like, it's not that big of a deal. Like, it's a flex.
Totally not a big deal,
It's like
deal,
you put
guys.
Your Grammy in your bathroom. Yeah. Like, it's a thing.
You said you put your grandma in the bathroom?
You put your grandma in the bathroom and you close the door.
You put your grandma on the wall in the bathroom.
Right.
How proud of you, grandma. Here
well, welcome, lit heads, to You Don't Know Lit, a weekly, as we call it, Strongly podcast, where every week we typically pick a theme, and Joe and Ian bring two book recommendations, and we have some rules to keep them on track. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe. And rule number three, doesn't matter, because it's about winning, and we only have one book today. So we're all a winner today. Well, no, technically, Ian is the winner today.
Right. I definitely lose today.
Ian, tell us about this book. Brené Brown. She wrote it.
Cassie Brown.
Yeah.
So, Cassie. Cassandra.
I'm going to start with a quote, actually, because I was trying to come up with a 30-second description of this. And I was like, wait, she does a pretty good job of describing what's going on in this herself. So
that makes sense.
Here's what she says. The big thing in this book is vulnerability. So this book is all about, this is still Ian talking, this is not Brené.
Okay.
Yeah, Dr. Brown, yeah.
It's going to do this impression.
I'll do my Brené accent. No, the book is focused on being vulnerable and the effect that can have. So here's how she talks about vulnerability early on in this book. Vulnerability is not knowing victory or defeat. It's understanding the necessity of both. It's engaging. It's being all in. Vulnerability is not weakness. And the uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure we face every day are not optional. Our only choice is a question of engagement. Our willingness to own and engage with our vulnerability determines the depth of our courage and the clarity of our purpose. The level to which we protect ourselves from being vulnerable is a measure of our fear and disconnection. So she's saying that
not much to disagree with.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's the thing. This is written 12 years ago. So maybe your ideas have caught on and become like kind of widespread.
Mainstream.
But I would say that, yeah, right. I would say that the core idea here, the sort of philosophical claim about the world, is that everybody screws up. Screwing up is like part of life. It's part of
this
being
is her
human.
Everybody poops.
Yeah, kind of.
Right.
And her question is, what then do we do with that? What should we do with it? So she says a lot of people, half of this book is acknowledging the risks of not being vulnerable, not being open. So she says a lot of people hide their vulnerability. They shield themselves from the negative effects there.
Like Joe does.
Oh, my goodness. 100%. I think that 100%. Beard is actually a shield.
Behind his rugged beard.
Your beard
and his
beard.
Machismo.
Yeah, absolutely. He broadcasts this sort of Casanova vibe into the world, and he's just trying to keep from being open with his feelings.
Behind that Casanova vibe, I'm actually a very thoughtful, very tender genius.
Oh, my gosh. Please never say that again. Genius. Okay, fuck you.
Is that your very stable genius?
If I mute him on Zoom, will he mute his recording too?
Will I mute in real life?
I don't think so.
Does he mute on Zoom? Does he mute in real life?
There we go.
Literally
that's
silence.
Great. I can mute you.
She
guys.
Talks about. She talks about. Brené Brown talks about silencing yourself, but what about silencing?
I can
others?
Turn his video off too, Ian.
Don't do that. We want to see him ride.
Oh.
So anyway, back to Brené. Some people hide or shield their vulnerability, the effects of that. Other people have learned to acknowledge their failures and repurpose them into growth. So she says, big surprise, the latter is better. And so the book kind of looks at, like I said, the why we fear being vulnerable, how we protect ourselves from being vulnerable, what the cost of this is to us, and how actually you can be, what it looks like to be vulnerable. So I'd like to start today with just a little exercise.
Ooh. Oh, okay. Do we have to get up?
Is it a game?
No, not trust falls. But if you want to do those, that would be really funny because you're both. Hey, have either of you screwed up recently?
Do you have to be vulnerable right now, Ian?
Oh, yeah,
I don't like this at all.
There is,
you know,
okay.
Lit heads. Ian didn't want to do self-help week, and I think this is his way of punishing us.
When I was okay, so when I was a kid, this is not about being vulnerable. It's about an exercise in vulnerability. when I was in high school,
so you're evading the question.
Deflection. Great.
We did. Yep. We went to Catholic Heartwork Camp, right? And Catholic Heartwork Camp is a mission trip sort of thing where you go across the country to some impoverished community and you like.
This is going to have nothing to do with the point.
No, it does. And one night of Catholic Heartwork Camp is, I don't know what they call it, but the way I remember it is the night when everybody gets together in a gym and cries, right? Like you,
Night of a Thousand Tears. It's known as Night of a Thousand Tears in Star Wars lore. Yes.
I wish I remembered this better because like it's this night where you get in and you talk about, I think like vulnerabilities and things you're ashamed of and things that you feel deeply about. And the result of that night is everybody cries, right? Like people are just in tears, sobbing and holding each other.
Did you think everybody else was crying or was it just you, Joe?
No. I ran out of that gym the second I saw what was going on. Like the second I saw that this was a big emotional cry fest, I went and waited in the hall with the other cool kids, right? Who were not going to be vulnerable, who were going to remain ironically detached from this sharing of feelings.
Kind of like that beard.
Ironic detachment. It's my shtick.
Okay. Well, what did you want us to do? Say something sad?
Have you screwed up recently?
Have I screwed up recently?
Done something stupid?
Yeah, I'd like to make a confession. Ian, you know that I recently sent Ian a very good sourdough starter.
I do.
And I had one. Right, it was now gifted to me. It's like a 150-year-old sourdough starter that they've like carried on the backs of like
mules,
mules and spies who died to get me this information.
Smuggled them out of Germany. Yeah.
So I ruined it. I left it sit out too long.
The chain stopped with Nick.
Yeah. Wow. But that's not really my confession. Wait, what was the confession? I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing.
What'd you screw up?
You're just talking about time
that
you screwed up.
That I sent you of the other sourdough, because I bought two when I first bought them. Yeah. I took a little bit out of that. I kept it for myself so I could make a new one.
I don't think that's you screwing up as much as you behaving vindictively.
No, that's amazing.
No,
that's
it wouldn't affect anything. I promise you, it won't affect your sourdough.
And it doesn't matter if it affects anything. Like thank you, Nick. That was really good. As opposed to Joe's ironic detachment, narrating how he thinks it's cool not to have feelings.
Oh, okay, well, I have a screw-up example.
Okay, Joe, go ahead.
Okay, I might have talked about this on the show already, but last summer when I was when I was working as a riverman last summer, I was in charge of a canal, right? For a whole weekend, I was in charge of a canal.
Crazy sentence with no context. What the hell are you talking about?
Nick,
I'm a riverman.
As the litheads know, the loyal litheads know, in the summers, one of my many things that I do is I work on the local river as a lock tender. I open locks, I close locks, I raise bridges, I lower bridges, I let boats through. And sometimes, as a lock tender, you are in charge of a whole canal by yourself. And the canal is, of course, bypasses the river. It's a safe spot.
Okay, we know what a river is.
You wanted
Joe.
Context.
We didn't
Nick.
Need that much context
last summer.
Hey, Nick, when someone's being vulnerable, we don't snipe at them, okay? We don't Waldorf and Stalin their vulnerability.
Okay. Last summer, when I was leaving for the night, I accidentally left a valve open on one of the lock doors. And when I came in to open the next day, the entire canal, and I want to be totally clear, this is miles of canal, miles.
You're
of
a waterman. This is not some, small riverway here. This is, akin to the Rhine.
Long story short, when I came in the next morning, the entire canal was empty. Empty down to the bedrock.
How many dead fish,
Joe? It was my fault. Thousands of dead fish.
No, really?
Thousands of dead fish.
No.
They were mostly carp.
Does the DNR know about this already? Like, is this, do I have to bleep this out?
Is the statute of limitations up?
Is this a criminal confession, Joe?
It was a really good lesson in the passive voice because as boats came up that day, well, number one, I got to learn how to refill a canal, which was amazing, right? Like I figured it was good. I learned how to refill the canal. As Brene Brown said, like I acknowledged my mistake and I learned.
Get a 12 pack of a case of water.
But it was a great lesson in the passive voice because as boaters came up all day and wanted to like use the canal that I had drained, I had to say to them, I said, hey, you can't go through the canal right now. It has been drained. The good news is I am fixing it.
Good. Okay. So you get to be the hero.
Ian, where are we going with this? These catastrophes? Is this just a trick to get us to say something that stupid that we did?
No, this is not just a trick. This is an exercise in the vulnerability that she talks about. And it's a part of it is beneficial for you because a lot of people, and she says this is based on the research she's done, a lot of people pretend to themselves that they don't make mistakes. So Joe's talking about
the set you free.
The passive voice, like, oh, the cookie jar was broken. Millions of people were genocided. The canal has been drained.
Whoa.
We do this to ourselves. Like we pretend that we didn't do things. We didn't make mistakes. But it's also useful because we pretend a lot to each other. She says that we have this, the U.S. and maybe kind of more broadly humanity. Oftentimes we have this approach of never enough. We can't do enough. We've always got to do more. We got to do better. We've got to be 100% all the time. And
rise and grind.
Yeah. What about grinding?
She says that acknowledging when we screw up, acknowledging that we've screwed up is important for ourselves and for other people. So she's got all of this evidence demonstrating that when people lead from a place of vulnerability, when people teach, when people parent, when
could
people
be applicable to you guys,
mm-hmm. when people are in romantic relationships and they do this vulnerable thing, it opens up connection. It makes businesses run better. It makes family and romantic life smoother. It makes teaching work better. So like being open seems like a bad idea.
Like everybody wants to be the guy who's right. Ego man.
Infallible.
Exterior of infallible. The person who never screws up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And part of this is because we believe counterintuitively, like despite what we see, we believe that people who are perfect can in
may fact be perfect. So, okay, give us some more though, Ian. We got it. Well, that's the premise, right? So how does she back all this up? Joe has a question. He's raising his hand.
Well, I have an example of
Joe, this is this
phenomenon.
About the canal?
No, it's not about the canal.
Have
it's
you killed more
other,
fish while we were talking?
Other life as a high school
guys,
English
the valve
teacher.
Is still open. Oops.
It's okay. It's okay, guys. They're just carp. They're just carp.
Who cares?
Carp are
not
disgusting.
Important to the
everybody
ecosystem.
Knows.
Well, yeah, they are. Well, are they Asian carp?
Not Asian carp. The regular American.
You would have
kind.
Gotten a medal if they were Asian carp.
No, but I have an example of what Ian's talking about here. We have a principal in our building. She's our head principal. She is a lady that is extremely good at her job, and I have seen her do something
lady?
Multiple times. She's a woman, a very powerful woman, very powerful and impressive woman who's extremely good at her job. I've seen her do something multiple times that I have never seen another boss do. And I think it's really effective. When she speaks to us whole group, when she has something that like genuinely affects her, genuinely that she's concerned about, I have seen her well up in full staff meetings. And you think that would be a bad thing. You think it would be like... I don't know, like showy or ostentatious or affected or something like that.
Yeah.
But it never comes across like that. It comes across as if she is genuinely moved, like she genuinely cares, like she's genuinely concerned. And you kind of, it's very hard to not be on board with her.
Is it when you tell stories though, Joe?
No, I don't speak very much in staff meetings. They took away my conscience.
Joe's microphone is permanently off. He cut the wire.
No, there's a whole policy. I don't want to get into it.
There's a part of the handbook. It's subsection Joe.
It's rule number two. Joe, where else are these? You got a lot of rules, huh? Okay, Ian, what... Ian.
Yes.
What? Tell us some more interesting things. I think we get the premise. What makes this an interesting book? Because I don't think that's unique.
So she unpacks like why we end up doing this kind of shielding, this hiding.
Like from a psychological perspective?
Yeah. So she talks about shame a lot. And she talks about the effect that shame can have. And she has this really interesting thing where she differentiates between shame and guilt. Shame, she says, says... Shame is saying, I am a bad person. I'm a crappy person. My nature is failure. Guilt, she says, is I did a bad thing. And she actually says it's better to have guilt, to feel guilt than to feel shame. Guilt is like, yeah, I screwed up. But that narrative, that sets you up for a narrative of, so next time I won't.
Right.
Shame, she says, is more kind of deep-seated, because shame says, I cannot succeed. I will always fail.
I screwed up, and that is who I am. It is indicative
exactly,
of who I
exactly.
am.
Sticks with you.
I screwed up because that's what I do. It's kind of like the Chicago Bears. You know, they right. continually struggle to develop quarterbacks. And
because
the shame perspective says the Bears are innately a failed, cursed franchise. And
right.
The guilt perspective says over and over they've failed, but maybe Caleb Williams is the guy. The point yeah. here is that she says the key to like beating shame, and a big part of the book is focused on shame and dealing with it, is what she calls shame resilience. So she says everyone feels shame. We can't avoid feeling shame. But the way that we deal with this is by being deliberate in terms of strategy and in terms of our culture, like the culture that we surround ourselves with, our personal, like family cultures or work cultures or educational cultures. The key to this is shame resilience. So finding ways to survive through the shame moments, the episodes when you are feeling like I'm nothing, I am worthless. I am the Chicago Bears of my school.
Of my life.
Right. I don't know if Chicago Bears is like a great analogy, though.
I think it's one of the best ones I've ever heard because they suck so much.
Because Joe. Like, I think they actually are bad at quarterbacks, though. Like, I think they right? should be ashamed. They are not learning from their mistakes.
So how does she... Okay, so what tools does she give people to combat these lingering feelings of when guilt turns into shame? And then follow-up question, Ian, all right?
Yes.
Two-parter.
Yes.
That means we've already accomplished the first part, and here comes yes. the second.
Yes.
What do we do when you should be ashamed? Like the Bears.
Sure.
When it is legitimate, does she... Yeah, when it is... when it is, in fact, you should be ashamed that you just... I mean, like, just screw up at every step. It seems like they just can't.
Sometimes ever I wonder. So, like, they famously right. took Mitch Trubisky before Patrick Mahomes in that one draft. And sometimes Ooh. I wonder that if they would have drafted Patrick Mahomes, if he would just be a laughingstock in the NFL. Like, yeah. is it actually something systemic about the Chicago product Bears of, that yeah, breaks right. quarterbacks?
It's right. got to be organizational. I mean, why do some organizations always succeed? I mean, money. That's the thing you could point to and just say, well, the successful organizations are the ones with the most money. But it does seem like Chicago has enough money.
Sure. It's a big city. It's second city.
Yeah. I believe last time I checked, I think Chicago was a bigger city than Green Bay. Interesting. Interesting. Why do they suck so much ass, Ian?
You ask what about when it's true? And I think she would say that shame is real. Everyone feels it. But she would say you shouldn't acknowledge the legitimacy of shame thoughts. Shame thoughts are generalizing.
I love shame thoughts, the terminology, shame thoughts.
Shame thoughts are across the board. Shame thoughts are big, sweeping value judgments. And what Joe and I are always telling our teachers about big, sweeping value judgments is don't. You've got to qualify. Mm-hmm. You've got to be specific. She would say the fact that the Chicago Bears have never had a quarterback pass for more than 4,000 yards in a season is not...
Right.
Necessarily
doesn't mean they're a bad person.
It doesn't mean they are by nature a broken organization. It means that they have never had this success. And at a certain point, it becomes, I think, kind of an academic question of like, okay, if you've never succeeded, perhaps you should say we should. And this is where the Bears analogy kind of starts to break down.
But the reevaluation,
I think she would say, feel guilt. Acknowledge guilt. Say, yes, I screwed up. Mm-hmm. And acknowledge that shame is always going to be there.
Right. But all those years
when
they
you
lost.
Hear, she says, when you hear the shame gremlins saying, it's because you're a bad person. It's because you're ugly and you'll never be pretty.
Go, Pack, go.
When you hear the shame gremlins talking, you've got to say, like, no, That's not, that's too generalizing. That's too broad.
That doesn't define me.
Doesn't define me. Yes, I make mistakes, but that's part of being a person. That's not part of being Ian or the Chicago Bears. Uh-huh. I make mistakes.
Or Joe.
No. Yeah. I make locker-related mistakes all the time.
Joe, I've never met anybody who's killed thousands of things before.
Well, you've met my dad. He's killed thousands of things just one at a time.
So it might be kind of like a learned behavior is what you're saying.
You know that thing, that hat that says, women want me, fish fear me? Is that because of this, Joe? Is that about you?
I don't know that hat, but we're going to sell that on our website from now on. What is it, Ian? Fish?
Women?
Joe
fish.
Kills women fish?
Want me,
Joe
women kills want fish. Me, you fish fear me. This is a reference to Joe Holshue and the great carp genocide of 2022. So I think that the back of the cereal box, the quick answer is that acknowledging that mistakes happen to everyone, that human beings are by nature, like we are imperfect. And in fact, by nature, humans do bad things. Like find a person who's never felt a selfish thought or said something cruel. There aren't any of them. Like every human being at some point has done things that are negative, that are bad, that are hurtful, that are unkind, that are self-centered. And she says, don't turn those things into, and that means I suck and I'm worthless. Turn those into, I'm going to be open with everyone about this in a decent, a kind of appropriate way. I'll talk more about that in a second. And I'm going to learn from this. So the other piece of this is that you got to be deliberate in how you are vulnerable. If I walked in and I was like, I told you guys, let's say I'd known you for like
your flaws.
Yeah. Let's say like our second meeting, the second time we talked on Skype or Zoom. And I was like, all right, so here are all my addictions and here are all of the homeless people that I've run over with my car.
Don't be a bad first date is what you're saying.
Right.
You gotta let that shit go slowly. It's gotta be a slow reveal stuff like that.
And it should never be self-serving. It should be honest, not trying to gratify yourself. So there are a lot of like very concrete, specific, if you're in a parenting situation and your kids are saying, wait, why am I in trouble for partying when you talk about how much you love to party when you were a kid? Here's what you do in that kind of a situation. The underlying principle is
hit them.
Honesty. No, the underlying principle is,
thank God you're here, Ian.
That's what I'm here for, baby. Be honest in moments of flaw, mistake, weakness. Be resilient to shame. Take off the shields to vulnerability. All the things that we do to avoid being vulnerable. Be deliberate. Think long term. Don't be reactive. There's one more piece of this, but Joe, you had your hand.
Well, I was just going to say, I think when I think back to that Catholic Heart Work Camp and all those kids crying in that auditorium, I think one of the things I found slightly repulsive about it, and maybe I didn't put this together until just now, is because like that moment seemed self-serving, right? Like it seemed like, oh, allow me to cry because it's like the thing that we're all doing.
Performative.
Right now. It's performative shame sharing, performative, not shame sharing, guilt sharing. I guess maybe shame sharing. And that's gross, guys. Dr. Brené Brown says it's gross.
What does the book say about like the audience's, like when the audience, like how do you know when the audience is ready to hear this?
Well, and like sometimes
Do you know what I mean?
I feel like I never want to hear it outside of people that I'm extremely close with, you know, like extremely close with.
So she's a bit, and the other big part of this is promoting connection. So you don't be vulnerable. What I did with you guys is actually kind of mean
because you made us mean, publicly brutal. Announce it.
It was artificial. Mm-hmm. It was like, this is not like you share yourself, your vulnerability. She says with people who you can really trust, people who you're really close to. So the Catholic heart work thing. No.
Yeah.
You're not.
It's a bunch of 16-year-olds that I met 4 days ago.
I think that the staff meeting examples are really good, and because like these are people that your principal works shoulder to shoulder with, people who share the same priorities, people
reading
who know the
room.
Same kids, and yeah. So she has this quote about love.
What about people who just can't read a room? God, there's so many.
They're They're bad. They're bad at that.
Right.
And they're bad people. Much like the Chicago Bears.
They should be
Bears.
Ashamed. Thank you.
This is like the Bears.
This is what she says about love. She says, love is not something we give or get. It is something that we nurture and grow. A connection that can only be cultivated between two people when it exists within each one of them. We can only love others as much as we love ourselves.
Gentlemen, welcome to Tiffany's. Ian, anything you didn't like about this book?
If I had to say one thing about this book that kind of bothered me a bit, it's that, so she had this TED talk in, I think, 2010 that went viral. It's still one of like the top five most viewed TED talks ever. And she does a lot of pulling on that TED talk to the extent that I wonder, this is obviously more, there's more here than was just in her TED talk, but there's a lot of the TED talk here. I'm not saying this could have been an article.
It could have been a TED talk.
It could have been like a series of TED talks. It's strange to me how much she brings it up. It kind of feels maybe a little bit like she's kind of proud of that going viral.
This is the book version.
The book, yeah, this is the book version of the TED talk.
Or it maybe feels calculated where it's like, oh, I had all this research that I was doing. I was doing some speaking already. Yes. I got invited to do a TED talk, which is like the big stage, especially in 2010. Like, do you guys remember how huge TED was?
Yeah, it
was
huge.
I don't know. If I had the biggest TED talk ever, I'd fucking talk about it constantly.
Yeah. Hey, welcome to my TED talk about that TED talk I gave. And I do think like maybe it was like, oh, that is a platform for me to launch a popular career.
A career. Right?
A career as a popular writer.
So I think that's a fault.
Well,
I'm not saying it's a fault. I'm just saying it kind of stood out.
Just kind of caught your eye. Well, that's pretty good if that was the worst thing about the book.
Absolutely.
Ian, Joseph, demand something from the Litheads, please.
Litheads,
tell them precisely what to do.
That you be vulnerable. I demand that you head on over to youdontknowlitpodcast.com. I demand that you go to tweenvogue.com.
Joe, may I?
Yes, please.
Help us help you, Litheads.
Good. Good one. Nice one.
Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, is there anything beyond
that?
No,
that's all I got.
Okay, I'm sorry. Help us help you, Litheads. Head to tweenvogue.com. Suggest a book. Request a book. Suggest a theme. Request a sticky. We read all of your requests, and then we go on to read some of your requests and talk about
them. No, we read all of them.
We read everything you send in, but then we read some of the books that you recommend.
No, we read all the books eventually.
Oh, okay. In the fictional world, that,
we've never discarded any recommendations.
That's
Joe.
True, but there are many on the list yet. Like there are many on the list that might be discarded.
I've established New Zealand.
Okay,
twice
Spain,
in New
Zealand, Turkey,
somewhere.
All right, I'm going to read the quote that I'm going to read is part of a speech from Theodore Roosevelt that gives the book its name. So the book is called Daring Greatly. And this is how she kind of begins the book and organizes her thinking around daring greatly, about being vulnerable. So Roosevelt gave this speech in 1910 in Paris. And it's a long speech and I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read the passage that made the speech famous. Roosevelt says, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows, in the end, the triumph of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly."